2005. We're going to go ahead and get started. We are a couple of minutes late getting started, and we are today going to take up the issue of capital gains. For those of you who have been reading your emails very closely, you've seen the capital gains issue right up there as a very important item. Let's start off today. I think we'll open both the House bills 2332 and 2574. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2332 and 2574. Elizabeth, you want to give us an update here, please?
Chairman Butler and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with I'll just go through both of them because they're quite similar, and once you start reading them, you'll notice that there's a few differences. So basically with House Bill 2332, what it's doing is reducing that capital gains tax rate for personal income and corporate excise taxes, and it's according to the following schedule that I've shown you there in your table. But basically, beginning in 2006, both these bills begin the tax rate reduction in 2006. Personal income tax rates go down half a point. And so it goes 8.5%, goes down a point between 2006 and 07 to 7.5, goes down another point in 08, goes down another point in 09 until it's fully phased in by 2010 at a rate of 5% for personal income taxes. And then on corporate side, it starts reducing in 2008. It goes down to 6.5%, then it goes down a full percentage point in 2009, and in 2010 it goes down to 5% also. So as you can basically, as everyone probably knows, but, you know, capital gains tax is treated just like any other personal income tax or corporate tax revenue. It's on the personal side, it's faced with the 5, 7, and 9 brackets, and on the corporate side, it's got the 6.6% tax rate. And these corporate income numbers are from the March 2005 forecast, so those are given to you in your staff major summary for both bills. But basically what we're seeing in 2003, we saw about $3 billion in capital gains income, which corresponded to about $254 million in personal income taxes. And it's projected to go up to as much as $6 billion by 2011, which would be about $500 million then in personal income taxes on capital gains. Now, the revenue impact for House Bill 2332 is very similar to the other bill, but basically you're going to start out in 2006 with a small reduction, because what we're assuming here is that most of the tax liability is going to come in April of the following year. So in 2006, people will be filing in April of 2007 as well as October of 2007. Also is an extended filing time period for capital gains. So we've split that up so that 75% of the capital gains comes in April of the following year, and then 25% comes in October of the following year due to the extended time period for capital gains income to be reported and taxes paid. So you've got a loss there of starting out of $12.3 million in 2006-07, and this does include some dynamic feedback effects of the capital gains tax rate reduction. So it includes some of the additional realizations of capital gain income from having these lower tax rates. But these estimates that I'm providing you here do not include the Oregon tax incident model capital gains cut feedback effects. So we will be discussing that in more detail. We haven't really had much of a discussion yet on the Oregon tax incident model. So we use that model a lot. Representative Hass would remember, I'm sure, from last session, but we kind of compared various stimulus bills with the Oregon tax incident model. So that's what we can do again this session, and this bill will be one of those. So we haven't incorporated those feedback effects yet, but you've got the basic static numbers with some portfolio additional portfolio effects on the additional capital gains income that will come in from the lower tax rates. So basically by 07-09, you've got a reduction of about $154 million, and then by 09-11 biennium, you've got a reduction of $336 million. Now, the only difference then with your other bill there, House Bill 2574, it's very similar to House Bill 2332, and the difference all is that by House Bill 2574, you're going down in 2010 to 4.5%. So you're going down an additional half a percentage point in 2010, and then in in the corporate side, you're going down to 4.5 also. So that's the only change. So you only, the only difference you have in your revenue impact then is in your 2010-11 fiscal year, there's a reduction of $200 million versus in 23-32, you had a reduction of $180 million, so roughly about a $20 million increase there just due to the half a percentage point further reduction in the capital gains tax rate. And just so everyone knows, too, this is based on the preliminary 2003 personal income tax statistics. So I did give you a breakdown there of those statistics. It basically is what the Department of Revenue reports every year for capital gains as well as other types of income. But it gives you a distribution by income groups of kind of the distributional breakdown for capital gains income. So what you see from this basically is that in 2003 you had 295,927 personal income tax returns that actually claimed a capital gains loss or increase, and then you had roughly about, that represented about 18% of all the returns. But what you see there is that taxpayers there that were above 500,000, they comprised 48% of the total net capital gain of roughly $3 billion. And then what you also see is taxpayers with adjusted gross income above $100,000 comprised about 83% of the total net capital gain in 2003. So basically that, you know, gives you an understanding of who is actually going to be benefiting from this tax cut. And when we run OTM, then at that time, the Oregon Tax Incident Model will give a distributional breakdown by different income groups of not only the capital gains tax cut, but also the feedback effects. And that will help you see, you know, where consumers are spending more of their money, then how that's going to split out then for different income groups.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Are there questions right now for Elizabeth? Why don't we go ahead and invite any legislators that are here to speak on behalf and Representative Scott Bruin, thank you for coming. We're honored to have any legislators come forward. And, Scott, we recognize that I think 2574 is your bill. So let's go ahead and please proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Bruin, State Representative from House District 37, which is Tualatin, West Lynn, and Stafford. And I'm here before you this afternoon to speak on behalf of House Bill 2574, a bill which would phase in reduction of Oregon's capital gains tax rate. I believe that if the legislature has one common goal this session, one goal that crosses party lines and in which we all can agree, it's the goal of job creation and economic growth. Why? Because job creation is the right thing to do for a state that has chronically led the nation in unemployment, and because economic growth and the tax revenues generated from that economic growth is what the state needs so that we can adequately and sustainably fund schools, universities, seniors, public safety, and other vital services. Mr. Chair, committee, I have the utmost confidence that the best thing that this legislature can do in the short term to provide immediate and sustainable economic growth would be to reduce Oregon's capital gains tax rate. Right now, at 9%, Oregon has one of the highest tax rates in the nation. According to Oregon Business Magazine, based on their calculation, Oregon does have the highest rate in the nation, number 50 out of 50 states. Great. And at the same time that we sit here with one of, if not the highest, most punitive, most prohibitive tax rates in the nation, we also want to compete for those jobs in those industries of tomorrow, high tech, nanotech, life sciences, biotech, and a whole spectrum of heavy and light manufacturing. These industries of tomorrow are all traded sector industries, the kinds of industries that produce the best paying jobs, produce the most tax revenue, and help insulate the state from economic downturns. But all of these industries, without exception, are highly capital intensive. Many of these, if not most of these industries, certainly including biotech and nanotech, are also very risky, meaning that the required return on investment when you add all the factors is quite high. Take all of those factors, combine them with the nation's highest tax rate, and I think it becomes self-evident that Oregon is losing investments, jobs, and tax revenue. Now, as the chair mentioned, as a joint chief sponsor of House Bill 2574, I have received dozens of emails, all identical, which criticize this bill for two primary reasons. Number one, the argument that it will lead to decreased tax revenue, and number two, the argument that this bill unfairly benefits the wealthy. To the first point, let me say this. If I thought that this very slow phase-in of a capital gains tax reduction would result in reduced capital gain tax revenue, I would not support it, period. But I do support it because I have unshakable confidence that the improved investment environment will materially increase investment and the exercise of capital gain transactions in Oregon. In fact, I have so much confidence that this reduction will lead to increased tax revenue that if I am still in this building when this law is fully implemented and we are not seeing more tax revenue, then I will happily donate a month's salary to a charity of the OEA or the AFL-CIO's choosing. And since we all know that a legislator's monthly salary isn't that much money, I will also not stand in the way of any efforts to repeal this tax decrease. This confidence is not wishful thinking. It is the incontrovertible truth, maybe even the paradoxical truth, that when capital gains taxes are reduced, capital gains tax revenues increase. This has proven true at the national level and among various states. It is also conversely true that when capital gains taxes are raised, as they were in 1986 federally and in 2001 in Virginia, capital gain tax revenues decrease. Now to the second part. That this bill unfairly benefits the wealthy. Let me say this. In the final analysis, a capital gains tax is a choice. It is a choice made by an individual or a business to incur a tax on the gains from an investment. And I'm here to tell you that it is a lot easier for the wealthy to choose not to exercise a capital gain than it is for the rest of us. The wealthy always get by. There's never a question to that. Where this tax hits the hardest is with the middle class, with the folks who just want to sell some stocks or investments or real property for any reason, to pay bills, to put kids through college, to start a small coffee shop or a bookstore or a home-based business, or to retire. It is these people that this tax hits the hardest and to whom it is the most unfair. Mr. Chair, capital is like any other asset. It is only valuable when it is fresh, when it is dynamic, and when it is being used for productive activities. We want people to exercise capital gains. We want capital to be invested and reinvested in Oregon. Simple example. We want people who, say, may own 200 shares of Coca-Cola and have been holding on to it for 20 years, stock and an investment that's doing absolutely nothing and that is stale, we want them to sell that. We want them to be incented to sell that and to reinvest those monies and that capital in Oregon to create Oregon jobs and dynamic Oregon businesses, both big and small. And the question should be asked, with the highest rate in the nation, how could we do anything but improve the economic incentive to invest in Oregon by reducing this rate? Simply put, this bill reduces the barrier between risk and reward. It will incent investment and job creation. Finally, Mr. Chair, committee, let's forget about tax rates for a moment. Let's forget about jobs and investment incentives and every other economic metric. Forget about all of that for a moment. This bill, at its heart, is about freedom. It's about one of the truest tests of freedom that we have in 21st century America. It's about the freedom to retain as much of the product of our labor and our property and our effort and our risk as possible while optimizing the tax receipts to government. With the highest rate in the nation, Oregon is optimizing neither freedom nor those tax receipts to the government. And I urge you to change this by supporting House Bill 2574. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Brun. Questions? Representative Galizio is recognized.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for taking the time to testify. I just had a quick question. How would you define middle class, giving, say, annual household income? What constitutes the middle class?
Quite a broad range. We know the rich when we see them, don't we? Because they're driving BMWs and Mercedes. Probably not anybody at the front table, I would imagine. I don't know what the true actual definition is. I would say it's certainly people making less than 100,000, probably significantly less than 100,000, probably in the 65,000 and less per household category. That's rough.
Follow up, Representative Fonte.
Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Other questions of Representative Bruin? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You've honored us by coming today. Any other legislators will just have to take their place, I guess, as they come down. I think there were a couple that wanted to present. Joe Schweinhardt. AOI.
Mr. Chairman, I've got our author of our AOI study here with us today, if I may bring him forward.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart, Associated Oregon Industries. I hope you have a little patience with us today. We're going to present a lot of facts about the capital gains tax reduction, and we're also going to get into the study which Dr. Connerly authored for the AOI Foundation, which will give you a little more detail on the effects it will have in Oregon. First of all, let me get into our economy. We hear reports that the economy is improving, and that news is great. But Oregon still has one of the highest unemployments for about almost 4 years running. Although there has been improvement, Oregon has been dragged along by the national economy. For the most part, the national economy is tenuous at best, as some states are moving ahead, others are not. Colorado's unemployment is 5%. Idaho is 4%. Arizona is 4.2%. In Oregon, manufacturing was the hardest hit during the recession. Small job growth is expected to level out, but start to decline in 2007. Oregon's high-tech sector is projected to decline or start some type of leveling off, also around 2007 as well, according to the Oregon Economic Analysis Report. Leading the increase in new jobs, though, in Oregon is from the service industry. There are other factors to consider on the health of our economy, such as high gas, energy prices, the falling U.S. dollar, and the war in Iraq. There's a lot that plays into this whole economy. Take another look at this. Look at the headlines from the Oregon press over the last several months to help describe the situation. In December 2004, the Business Journal, Portland dollar drain, tax advantages drive many top executives across the river. September 2004, the Oregon Labor Market Information Systems report, low-wage industries fuel much of Oregon's job growth. The Argonian, June 2004, Vancouver leads area's growth. And one that we've talked about before in January 2004, also from the Business Journal, there was a survey. 38% of Oregon businesses would consider relocating. Other headlines address the high unemployment rate, thousands of wage earners out of jobs, earners with and without needed education or training, still not able to find jobs, families struggling to make ends meet, and many wage earners taking lesser paying jobs. This economic pain is not only in unemployment numbers, but also in the eyes of policymakers like you. Not enough money to meet priorities. Everyone wants and needs more revenue than we have. Oregonians are being hurt by short-range policies which are only hurting us long-term. Perhaps Governor Kulikowski said it best in his statement regarding his proposed budget for 2005-2007, and I quote, "For state government, that means we need to prioritize our budget choices, continue to exercise budget discipline, and target investments for the future. We must stop allowing the budget to turn into a series of choices between bad options, and instead treat it as an opportunity to pursue our vision for a bright future," end quote. All right, let's get into why capital gains. Oregon is an income tax state. We rely on the income taxes to fund approximately 87% of our general fund. As long as unemployment is high, there will continue to be budget issues. Oregon needs to encourage companies to expand and locate in Oregon and lessen these effects of unemployment. The economy may improve with the rising stock market, but if we do not create jobs, our budget issues will not change. Oregon needs to move away from relying on slow rising tax revenues and find ways to increase the tax base. We need to create wealth. Cutting costs on investment and creating jobs will accomplish this task. We need to take advantage of opportunities to work our way to prosperity. We need to make Oregon more business friendly, give Oregon business an opportunity to grow, and for Oregon become a destination of choice for business big and small. Nashville, Tennessee's success in luring Louisiana Pacific Corporation from Oregon helped catapult that city into number two on the list of America's 50 hottest cities for expansion. Portland came in number 47, according to a survey by Expansion Management Magazine. The survey further stated the perception that corporate executives have of various communities is extremely important, especially when perception is shared by large numbers of their counterparts. A study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta provides fresh evidence that high taxes are bad for the state's economic health. An article found a strong relationship between taxes and growth. Again, I quote from that article, relative marginal tax rates have a statistical significant negative relationship with relative state growth, end quote. Other research on state taxation includes a study by the Journal of Public Economics, Leslie Papke, in 1991, found that state tax rates have a significant impact on new business startups. Business Week magazine in 1994, a study found that job growth in low tax states was 65% higher than in high tax states. Richard Vedder of Ohio University found in a study in 1995 that on average 1% increase in state and local taxes lowers personal income growth by 3.5%. Bruce Bartlett of the National Center for Policy Analysis found one reason that taxes affect growth is that investors increasingly look at tax rates to guide not only direct investment decisions, but portfolio investments as well. In other words, many investors look at taxes in a particular state and decide whether or not to buy stock of that company located there. My suggestion today, as it was last session, is to cut capital gains rate. Cut it in half over 5 years. House Bill 2574 cuts that tax rate by 0.5 point to lessen the effect on this biennium and take 1 point off the next 4 succeeding years. Before I discuss the merits of such a cut, let me further illustrate the need again. Headlines in the Site Selection magazine in November 2004, just about 4 or 5 months ago. It read, Texas triumphs. Texas ranked number one for site selection for business for its pro-business attitude and for capital investment. It has zero capital gains. On that list, Oregon didn't rank in the top 25, which means it's not a primary destination for business. In a study by Pacific Research Institute, taken from Forbes Best Places magazine in May of 2004, found that Oregon ranks low in economic freedom. The study measured how friendly state governments are toward free enterprise. They found Oregon ranked 31st out of 50 states. They examined such factors as taxes, environmental regulations, tort laws, and property rights. Now let's talk about the capital gains tax. The capital gain is income derived from the sale of an investment. A capital investment can be a home, a farm, a ranch, a family business, or a work of art. In most years, less than half the taxable capital gains are realized on the sale of corporate stock. The vast majority of assets have value only because they are expected to produce future income. The current taxation of inflationary gains, together with high statutory capital gains rates, creates a powerful lock-in effect. Since selling is taxed and possessing is not, high capital gains rates encourages investors to hold rather than sell, thereby avoiding the tax indefinitely. In Oregon, these same funds are invested in other states or held until death to avoid capital gains tax altogether. I want to address the issues which explain why this reduction is so important and why it is needed now. Although information I will be presenting is from several sources, you will find one of the studies and some of the charts from the Institute of Policy Innovation, Policy Report Number 164, which has been handed out to you. The four issues of importance I want to address are, one, does a cut in capital gains mean more state revenue? Two, who pays capital gains taxes and is it fair? And three, does capital gains taxes affect business creation and environment? And lastly, how will a capital gains tax rate cut and enhance Oregon's global competitiveness? The first issue, does a cut in the capital gains mean more state revenue? It's probably that state government would see a windfall after such a tax cut took its full effect. For every percentage cut, the rate of taxation of capital gains would increase revenues by 6% from those funds. Remember, when the rate is high, investors simply delay selling their assets, stocks, property, businesses, and in Oregon's case, they moved to Vancouver. Critics are quick to say it will raise little revenue. But the reliance on static revenue forecasting and the failure to take into account the economic adrenaline that a capital gains tax cut can provide can lead to such conclusions. At the federal level, the capital gains tax rate cut in 1997 also provided two other important economic trends. It provided risk capital funding for new business startups increased by nearly 50%, and the stock market soared. Now let's look at the evidence of that 1997 federal tax gains cut, if I can get this to work. That gives you a pretty good idea. I'm going to let it sit right there. Let's look at the evidence from the 1997 federal gains tax cut. The only true predictor of the future is the past performance of the capital gains cut. As you can see by the chart, the lower the rate, the more return is received. Particularly look at the 1978-79, when the rate was cut, and then back in 86.
Joe, is this information we have in the packets?
No, this is on the chart here.
Okay.
When the federal rate went from 28% to 20%, it did not lead to any of the revenue losses that had been expected. The year before the tax cut, the amount of net capital gains on assets sold for $260 billion. The year after the tax cut, it was $400 billion. Conversely, the reverse action in 1986 of raising the capital gains caused total assets to disappear from $326 billion to $154 billion. William Beach of the Heritage Foundation in 1995 found that over the past 30 years, every time the capital gains tax was been cut, capital gains revenues increase.
Joe, do we have, and Representative Bruin mentioned that an eastern state had actually cut its capital gains rate. That eastern state, do we have the name of it and how much theirs may have increased with regard to their collections?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's going to be part of the study we have from Virginia.
You.
And we will get into that. Our proposed capital gains cut would gain revenue three ways. First, it would unlock the short-term assets that would not have been sold. Two, it will increase the value of stock and other local capital assets traded. And three, it will increase long-term economic growth from the capital formation, which would raise tax collection from income taxes and other sources. Now let's take on issue number two. Who pays the capital gains tax and is it fair? The tax fairness question is always raised by opponents of the tax cut. A common claim is that 60% of the tax break will go to households with incomes above $200,000. Opponents wrongly use the equity issue to oppose the bill. Evidence suggests that the rate reduction would promote tax fairness, benefit taxpayers of all income levels. There are three basic reasons for this. Economic growth. Everyone realizes capital gains and capital gains taxes punish the elderly. Let's look at the first one. And hopefully I can get this to work again. Okay. Economic growth benefits all income groups. If a capital gains cut generates new investment and new jobs, as all evidence suggests, everyone will reap the rewards of a stronger economy and more jobs. For example, when the federal tax gains cut rate was lowered in 1981, the incomes of all groups rose, and the unemployment rate fell to nearly 3% in 1986. Everyone benefited. Another issue is, why just the wealthy realize capital gains income? Excuse me. A capital gains tax rate reduction will reduce taxes for all income groups. IRS data indicated that 42% of all returns reporting were from households with incomes below $50,000. 72% for households with incomes below $100,000. Looking at the numbers from Oregon, and I'm going to let Dr. Connolly get into that, but we can see that 57% of those who file income have income under $60,000. Many people report capital gains in large numbers but are not wealthy. The situation is known as bunching. Bunching arises when a taxpayer realizes long-term gain relative to an average income. Such a taxpayer bears a much higher liability on a gain upon realization than he would under actual accrual taxation. Now let me give you an example. Let me illustrate this. A woman has a middle-class income from all her life, but sells her business for $150,000 when she retires. She is labeled wealthy for capital gains. A struggling farmer who sells the family farm to avoid indebtedness is labeled rich because the once-in-a-lifetime sale substantially inflates his income for that single year. Joseph Manerick with the Urban Institute, in testimony before the U.S. Senate Finance Committee in March of 1990, testified that his research through IRS data found that bunching increased the tax liability of 88% of those taxable capital gains. Jack Sigmund of the American Council of Capital Formation found that over a five-year period, only 16% of tax filers had capital gains income each year, while almost 50% reported taxable income gains in only one of 5 years. The evidence is conclusive. Ed Rubenstein, National Review in 1996, found that most capital gain taxpayers are middle class at the national level. 75% of all taxpayers paid capital gains had normal incomes of less than $75,000. The IPI study found that in the 1970s, about 2 in 10 Americans owned stock. Today, that's 5 in 10. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce Office of Tax Policy found that after the 1991 rate reduction, total capital gains taxes paid by Americans with earnings over $500,000 per year rose threefold. All evidence suggests that behavior does change when the rate is reduced and more capital gains are recorded. In the Journal of Economic Perspectives, number 1 in 1991, found that the rich would pay more than 16 to 20% more in capital gains. Bruce Bartlett, senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis in Washington, D.C., found in his research that well over half of all taxpayers with capital gains had an adjusted gross income of less than $50,000. Now, the third issue, capital gains tax will punish the elderly. The bunching effect I explained earlier is very common among people entering retirement. Elderly who have accumulated wealth over the individual's working life and is meant to serve as a nest egg for retirement are punished. The elderly are two and a half times more likely to realize capital gains in a given year than tax filers under the age of 65. Capital gains tax punishes the elderly, not the rich. The tax rate is also a severe penalty against couples that have frugally saved during their working years to sustain themselves during retirement. Now, the third big issue I'd like to look at as we move forward is, does the capital gains tax cut affect business creation and investment? One of the strong potential benefits from reducing the capital gains tax is to divert investment funds to new business startups, where investments are risky but potentially large payoff. This is particularly true of our economy because studies indicate that small businesses create as high as 80% of all new jobs. The evidence is clear. Over the past 20 years, reduction in capital gains taxes stimulated the financing and startup of new businesses, while new businesses stalled under increases in the capital gains taxes. Take another chart here, which shows the capital gains tax and venture capital. Not only are more small business startups and IPOs during periods of low capital gains taxes, but also the stock of smaller firms appear to outperform that of larger corporations. The effects of increases in growth overwhelm all the downside concerns about cutting the capital gains tax. Since economic growth drives all benefits, job creation, competitiveness, government revenues, and spurring small business creation growth, these benefits cannot be outweighed by any other aspects of such a cut. Remember, there are 10 states with zero capital gains, including Nevada, Washington, and Wyoming. These 10 states' average unemployment rate is about 4.8%. In the recent study by the Institution of Policy Innovation in October of 2001, what's the most potent way to stimulate the economy provides compelling evidence that any economic stimulus plan should include a capital gains cut. The study shows that capital gains cut would grow the economy by more than $10 for every $1 lost. The economic evidence is clear. The capital gains tax rate reduction would increase capital investment, new business formation, jobs, and the rate of economic growth. In Oregon, we have one of the slowest economic growth in our gross state product in the West. Washington and California has a growth of about 5.1 to 5.7% respectively. Oregon is at 4.5. By cutting the capital gains, we see a significant increase in the state product. The Oregon Business Magazine article in August of 2004, let me get that on the, reported that Venture Economic Survey completed by PricewaterhouseCoopers in 2004 found that venture capitalists invested $18.2 billion in the U.S. In California, they invested $7 billion alone. But going down the list, Washington got $385 million. But as you'll see, Oregon only got $99
million. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hess?
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you, Joe, but
that's okay.
California has a higher capital gains rate than Oregon, and they're at the top of that list. So how would you reconcile that?
I'd only reconcile from the standpoint that California is almost like another country. Their economy is so big and so large that one tax versus another would have less of an effect.
But aren't they seen as kind of the venture capital of the world?
Is California seen as that?
Yes.
Yes.
But if I follow your logic then, on that couple slides back, you said that this is what's holding down capital gains rates, seem to hold down venture capital.
In Oregon, yes. Well, the point to be made is California is a huge, huge, was the fifth largest economy in the world. And there are so many other factors that play into theirs that makes a huge difference on who invests and how much, and the fact that their economy is so big to begin with. Versus when you get to Oregon, our economy isn't as big, and we do need some type of, I would say, stimulus to get that investment more. We want more investment. Everybody in the state wants more investment, and cutting the capital gains tax will do that. Where in California, it may not make nearly as big an effect because their economy is so big.
Well, I guess I have a question about the premise. How is it that Oregon has the highest of 50 states' capital gains tax, and California has a higher tax than the state of Oregon? I'm missing something.
Oregon doesn't have the highest.
No, that yeah.
Oregon does not have the highest.
Second or third.
Okay.
Third.
Okay.
That's one of the highest as well.
Okay.
All economists agree capital formation is essential to restoring growth to the economy. Mm-hmm. Now let's take on issue number four. How will a capital gains tax rate cut or enhance Oregon's global competitiveness? One indication of which nations will prosper economically and why we fall behind is the flow of international capital. All over the world, tax rates are falling as political leaders realize that high tax rates do not redistribute income, they redistribute people. The same can be said for each of the 50 states. We must keep pace since we are in a true global economy. In Oregon, this is very important because of our manufacturing base. Oregon manufacturing accounts for over 20% of our economy, 10% of our exports. In Oregon, 142,000 jobs are tied to manufacturing exports, and only four states have a larger share of their private sector employment tied to manufacturing exports. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, two of these states are Washington at 11.7% of their economy and Idaho at 10.3%. Washington has zero capital gains. Idaho has 3.1% capital gains. They understand the importance. Arch Dunham, chairman of the National Association of Manufacturers in March 2003, had this to say about the importance of manufacturing to the economy. Manufacturing has one of the largest, highest, multiplier effects in terms of job creation. Every 1 million in final sales for manufactured products stimulates 8 jobs in the manufacturing sector and 6 jobs in other sectors, such as services, construction, and agriculture. Thus, in addition to providing 16.5 million jobs nationally, manufacturing supports 9 million jobs in other sectors. Manufacturing employment in Oregon slumped almost 17% from 1998 to the mid-2003. Coming back has been very slow. It is predicted to grow only 1.3% in 2005. Overall employment growth is going to be about 1.8% in 2005. Oregon manufacturing, as well as our economy, works at the international level. We must be able to compete not only with other states, but with other countries. We must have a level playing field to be competitive in world markets, including tariffs and tax policies. Other countries are realizing this. Capital gains tax rate reduction will help Oregon meet those goals. In summary, I'm glad you're, I know you're glad to see that I'm coming to an end, but there's a lot to be said. In summary, we have examined the length and depth of Oregon's current economic situation. It needs help, and we cannot wait to be pulled along by a slow-moving national economy. We need to look not just at the problems facing us this biennium, but we look to future bienniums. We need to give Oregonians the opportunity to work. It's simple economics. We need a capital gains cut. We have examined an overwhelming amount of experience, the state and federal level, that demonstrates that cutting capital gains does work. The evidence is clear. Capital gains tax rate reduction would increase capital investment, increase new job formation or new business formation, jobs, increase the rate of business growth. Now that we work in a global economy, nothing could be more important. And I urge your support.
Thank you very much, Joe. While we have Dr. Carnley here, Bill, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I'd just have a couple of brief remarks, unless you want the lengthy version. I've never been asked for the lengthy version.
If an economist could keep us just wide awake, maybe just go ahead and drop the temperature another 10 degrees in the room. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you. Let me begin with a little bit of perspective on what the capital gains tax cut proposal can and cannot do. The capital gains tax is one of many factors affecting the economy. If you cut capital gains, I cannot guarantee that we will not have a recession in the future. Maybe Joe will, but I won't guarantee that. If you keep the high capital gains tax rate, there will be years in which Oregon is booming. So, just the fact that you have occasionally seen a state with high taxes also have a good economy, that I'm not saying that isn't possible. But there is an effect, on average, year after year, of the capital gains tax rate on the economy, and that's what the AOI Foundation asked me to look at. And I'm getting results that suggest that this proposal for a tax cut is revenue neutral, plus or minus a couple million dollars, revenue neutral in the early years, and a very big revenue positive in the out years. That's a different result than I got 4 years ago when I did a study for AOI. And let me tell you why it's a little bit different. Economists started fiddling with the mathematics of growth, economic growth, writing lots of equations with little Greek letters, which I'm sure the staff of Legislative Revenue Office could brief you on, so I won't go through the calculus and equations. But the general conclusion from that body of research was that if you change the investment environment, you get a one-time stimulus to the economy. And then after that one-time stimulus, which may take like 5 years to work through, you're at a higher level, but you don't have more rapid growth. So if you're growing at 3% a year, you have a nice bump for 5 years, and then you go back to 3% annual growth. And we economists have used that model, and the Oregon tax incidence model sort of has that same approach. There's been some recent research suggesting that if you're a small economy in a world in which capital moves around, that you can get a sustained increase in your economic growth rate by changing the investment environment. I cited that and last time around 4 years ago and said, well, gee, if this guy is right, then the tax cut is revenue neutral or revenue positive. This time in my research, I went looking specifically, developed a database that covers 50 states and the District of Columbia over a 27-year period, looked at the changes in their capital gains tax rates over that period, correlated it with their economic growth, and I find that a lower capital gains tax rate causes a small but statistically significant stimulus to economic growth on a year-in, year-out basis. It's 0.9% economic growth per percentage point, but that will accumulate over time. So we stimulate the economy. If you bump, if you cut the capital gains tax rate from like 9% to 4.5%, that 0.9% increases the annual growth rate by about 0.4%. So in terms of numbers, our employment growth over the last 13 years in Oregon. We've been growing jobs by 1.7% a year, and I'm saying instead of 1.7, it could be 2.1. So it's not a panacea, but if you go from 1.7 average to 2.1 average, over time, it's definitely going to accumulate. So I found evidence of faster employment growth, faster growth of inflation-adjusted personal income. I also looked at venture capital. We don't have quite as much data on that, but I found a significant effect on venture capital. And I'd like to add, a lot of people say, gee, venture capital funds typically are not taxable entities. Why would the capital gains tax rate matter? And what seems to be happening is before a venture capital fund invests, a startup is begun with the founder's money, family money, friends' money, angel investors, and these are all taxable entities. So the low capital gains tax rate helps our companies get ready for venture capital funding. Finally, I estimated the effect on revenue, and the numbers are really stunning in that the first few years, we're talking about like a $2 million revenue loss, $2 million with an M, obviously plus or minus a little bit. Then when we get into the out years, we're getting $100 to $300 million per year, twice that per biennium, additional revenue because of the higher rate of turnover of capital assets, but most significantly because we have grown the economy and created additional jobs. I did a sensitivity analysis to see what happens if I'm wrong on one of my assumptions, and regardless of which assumption you change, we still continue to get evidence of a long-run revenue gain, though some of the assumptions, if I'm wrong on that, might cost us as much as like $30 to $50 million in a single year.
But it would still be positive, is what you're saying, in the out years.
Yeah, positive, but still positive in the out year. So I am very heartened at the idea of reducing the capital gains tax rate as a way to stimulate the Oregon economy, and I think it is something that will stimulate enough economic activity that we don't have to argue about whether it is worth spending the money because we're going to be more or less revenue neutral. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions for either Mr. Swinehart or Dr. Connerly? Representative Hess, recognized.
Thank you. I've read the study. Thank you. And your contention, basically, that differs from the Oregon tax incidence model is that instead of sort of a one-time benefit that these economists or that computer model has found, you contend that it's more continuous. Is that pretty much?
Yeah, Representative Haas, Chairman Butler, that's the biggest difference. There are some other minor differences, but that's, in a nutshell, the biggest difference.
Well, Chairman Butler and Representative Haas, I just want to at least clarify. The Oregon tax incident model phases in the impacts over 5 years, and he assumes it right away. So that's one clear difference. And his model is an econometric model. That's certainly not the same thing as a computable general equilibrium model. So we're talking really apples and oranges as far as what exactly is the model to come up with the estimates. Now, the Oregon tax incident model has dozens of different elasticity assumptions given the different income groups, given the different industry groups, and these are assumed from cross-state analysis. So you come up with one elasticity for the different for employment and then for personal income. And so it's gone over different states in order to come up with an elasticity that is averaged by the different states, where Oregon tax incident model is specific for Oregon. It's based on Oregon data. And so there's, you know, as far as the time period, it's clearly a difference as far as whether you're going to think these impacts are going to occur right away or whether it's going to take 5 years in which to see them. But then once OTM's results are finally completely implemented after 5 years, you still would see that change over each year after that. It's just a change in the static equilibrium from one to the other.
Okay.
I'm
not going to put you on the spot, but I guess which one then would you say is more reliable?
Well, Chairman Butler and Representative Hess, they're completely different studies. I mean, they really aren't I mean, this is geared towards capital gains. OTM can handle a variety of different tax changes. And so, you know, it really is, and it was designed, again, on Oregon's data. It separates out Oregon's consumers and our consumption patterns and stuff in the different industry groups. So, and that's not at all anything that this model did. This looked at different states. And basically makes conclusions from looking at other states and then comes up with this average and then from that brings and makes those assumptions to Oregon data.
Elizabeth, your revenue impact does not include the dynamic feedback at this particular point.
Chairman Butler, it does not. But, you know, I think what he was referring to in this, in the book and stuff, is some runs that we did 2 years ago in the 2003 session. So
that's correct.
Okay.
Okay, we'll just put that issue aside for now. And one of the issues for me on the capital gains has been if, because federal taxes are deducted, if you save $5,000 as a result of a capital gains tax cut, that's less than you'll be able to, you won't be able to deduct that then from your federal tax bill. So depending on your bracket that you're in, 20, 30%, whatever, say you're probably in the 30%. that's 30% of that 5,000 that goes right to the federal government. And so that reduces that impact then of, you know, to 70%. And I'm just wondering if you factored that into your study and what you think about that and whether there's a way to neutralize that.
Chairman Butler and Representative Hass. I looked at that in the previous study, and for many of the people paying the capital gains tax, you know, there's a phase out of your deductions at certain income levels so that some taxpayers don't get the full benefit of getting to deduct state income taxes on their federal tax return.
That's the clawback effect of the Schedule A?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I confess I'm not an expert in filling out tax returns. I've got to call into my accountant on that issue right now. In addition, we have the alternative minimum tax. And as a result, not only is it hard to tell what the impact on a taxpayer is going to be, but for many taxpayers, we don't get that clawback, and that effect would be minor. Especially for the higher income taxpayers, there'd be very little benefit to them. The middle class and lower, the middle class taxpayers would be affected, as you described.
Okay, if I can just
follow up more. Yes, please.
According to our economists here, 83% of the benefits would go over to people with over $100,000 AGI. And I'm just wondering if we were going to cut taxes and we did it for a lower income, say the benefits all went to people earning over $50,000, what effect do you think, realizing you haven't studied that, but if we were going to cut taxes by the same amount, what effect would it have if we cut taxes on those earning, say, above $50,000, just a straight income tax cut?
Chairman Butler, Representative Hass, it's important to keep in mind how a cut in capital gains stimulates the economy. And the key factor is not that a certain group of people have more jingle in their pocket after the tax cut is done. The effect comes because of an incentive to invest here. And if you just wanted to put more dollars in people's pockets, there's an argument for cutting taxes on lower income rather than upper income people. But if you want to stimulate the economy through investment, venture capital, and other forms of investment, then you need to have a tax cut that impacts the people who have discretionary wealth to invest. And those are the people in the upper income category.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can
follow up.
I've always wondered how do you know whether they'll invest in Oregon? We had the discussion about 2,000 shares of Coca-Cola. What if somebody saves $5,000 and decides, okay, I'm going to buy, you know, Dell Computer or shares of IBM? That doesn't help Oregon or its taxpayers at all.
Yeah, Representative Past Chairman Butler, you're right, and we cannot tell. Noodled on this for a while, and I'm maybe not smart enough to figure out how to tell how much of the additional investment will be by Oregonians investing in Oregon. But I do know that in the aggregate, we have very strong statistical evidence that the states with lower capital gains rates grow faster. So I think that you'll be benefiting some people who invest in other states, but you'll also be benefiting the people who invest here. You'll be retaining more people who don't feel compelled to move to Clark County when it's time to sell a business or to start peeling off shares of stock in their retirement. So those are the avenues, but it's hard to point your finger and say this stimulates this and not that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions for Joe or Dr. Connelly? Yes, Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. My question is, early in the presentation, I think, Joe, you said that there's 10 states that have no capital gains tax.
Yes.
And I was wondering if we could get the information of which states have the capital gains tax, which don't, and also kind of a category that tells us, I mean, we know we're so reliant on our income tax in Oregon, and what are the taxing revenues in those other states that do have a capital gains tax? Does that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Call, definitely. We can get to you what the tax rates are in other states in a variety of... Because there's a huge number of different situations.
Right, and, well, and the reality what's going through my mind is whether it's California or Iowa or whatever state, that there are variables, an array of variables with how different states tax. So it seems like we're juggling a lot of lemons and oranges here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kopp, there's a lot of different taxes, a lot of different situations, a lot of conceivably smaller parts from each state that are different. Mm-hmm. But the one constant that gave that zero capital gains was the unemployment when you compare the unemployment to
great.
The capital gains.
That'd be great. That'd
but
be
obviously
helpful.
There are other ways.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Galizio is recognized.
I have two questions. One is there was an agreement that $12.39 billion was sort of the foundation that we're working with, and I understand that the immediate revenue impact is not large, but there is some immediate revenue impact. So my first question is any suggestions where we might get that? And secondly, I'm just constructing this, I think, very realistic scenario where I knock on someone's door and they say to me, you know, health care, you know, the Oregon Health Plan is suffering. We have seniors are suffering. Class sizes are increasing. We're coming out of recession. And you want to give a tax break for Phil Knight and Paul Allen. And I understand it's not to put more jingle in people's pockets, like you said, but the reality is that's how it will be perceived. So my question is, how would I respond to those people?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, on your first question, I mean, our report and our study says there really shouldn't be any cost for this, and even less than $13 million biennium. But the fact is, the thing that, in my mind, the thing that jumps out at me is, if you're willing to stimulate the economy by a capital gains cut, the obvious place to go would be somewhere where they do economic development, and that'd be our Economic Development Department, who gets over $400 million in revenues. You know, $13 million out of their budget may be the best way they could spend money to stimulate the economy. Your second question... in terms of what would I tell people, you know, what we did last session and possibly what we're looking at this session is we look at shortfalls in the budget. I don't know if we could ever have enough money to make up all of it. But when I look at it, the idea is that we want to stimulate the economy for more revenue. And the way to do that is to get more jobs. And unless we have more jobs and more revenues, conceivably next biennium you guys are going to be back here looking again at some shortages, or maybe not shortages, but not having enough money to fund what you want. So I think it's a question of trying to look long range and make those changes that will make us stronger in the future.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you, Bill. Representative Hunt is here. Representative Hunt, did you want to take any time? Okay. Thank you very much. We will then continue on. Eric Blackledge is here. And then Terry Lamers.
Chairman Butler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Blackledge, owner of Blackledge Furniture in Corvallis. I'd like to speak in favor of these bills from two perspectives. First, I support the bill from a small business perspective. As a member of the Oregon Governor's Small Business Council and as the Northwest Region Tax Issues Chair for the U.S. Small Business Administration's Office of Advocacy, I support the bill because high capital gains taxes have a significant negative impact on small businesses. And small businesses account for over 98% of Oregon businesses and provide over 60% of total state employment. Oregon's capital gains tax rate is one of the highest in the nation. I have attached a chart which will answer Representative Topp's question of the capital gains tax rates in all states. 10 states have no tax on capital gains, and 20 of them have a tax rate of less than 5% on capital gains. Salaried workers receive many tax shelter incentives to save for their retirement, such as 401k plans, Roth IRAs, or the public retirement system. Small business people, on the other hand, usually out of necessity, invest most of their retirement assets into their businesses or properties, which after paying taxes year after year, then get taxed again at the full regular tax rate on the capital gain in the year that they sell them. Capital gains are also particularly inequitable because a significant percentage of the taxable gain is often just inflation. If I buy a business or property as a way to save for my retirement, it costs $500,000 now and would pay for 10 years of living expenses, and it inflates in value at just the average inflation rate for 15 or 20 years, it may technically be worth $1 million, but it will still only pay for 10 years of equally inflated living expenses. And after paying federal taxes and a 9% state income tax on the $500,000 gain, it won't even buy that. But I also support this bill from an economic development perspective. As the past chair of the Tax and Public Policy Committee of the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative and a member of Governor Kitzhaber's last tax policy advisory group, I support the bill because Oregon's high capital gains tax rate is a significant disincentive to locating a fast-growing, profitable business in Oregon, and it reduces the availability of capital and management expertise for new business development. When faced with a high capital gains tax, successful entrepreneurs who have built their first business and are ready to sell it have a financial incentive of 9% of the increased value, less the federal offset, which is not the full amount of that, to leave Oregon for states such as Washington or Florida that have no state income tax. The tax savings are often enough to buy them a new house or a much nicer house than they've had in Oregon. Many owners also relocate or choose to locate initially successful small businesses in other states in anticipation of rapid value growth to completely avoid the capital gains tax in Oregon, causing Oregon to lose not only any capital gains tax revenue, but also the continuing taxes on owners' and employees' income, which, as you know, is our major source of tax revenue. Many of these successful business people later start new businesses or provide mentoring and investment capital to other startup businesses in their new home state. So losing these successful entrepreneurs is a major long-term loss for Oregon's economy. Most individuals with substantial capital gains also have lots of other income. As you saw from the charts distributed by Legislative Revenue Committee, there is a noticeable propensity for capital gains to be among higher income individuals. Those individuals are also paying state income taxes, obviously, on all of their other sources of income. And these people probably pay far more in taxes than they use in state services. These are the kinds of citizens we should be trying to attract to Oregon, not drive away. You're also probably thinking of this bill as a tax reduction, and in a sense, in the short term, it is. But it really isn't in the long term. It's actually a long overdue return to Oregon's traditional tax level on capital gains. In 1986, when the federal tax code was revised to replace the 60% long-term capital gains exclusion from gross income, which on which the Oregon taxes are calculated, with lower federal tax rates, Oregon's tax rate on capital gains effectively more than doubled from 3.6% maximum to 9% maximum. Congress has further reduced federal tax rates on long-term capital gains to encourage investment and economic growth at the federal level, but these changes, because of the nature of the change, have not affected Oregon's tax level. We all know that the state is experiencing a budget shortfall, but I hope you will remember that the long-term economic consequences of continuing a poor tax policy are not good for the state. Even if Oregon can't immediately reduce the capital gains tax burden, we can at least adopt one of these bills to show potential investors that a gradual reduction will occur and that Oregon is a good place to grow a business. Although it's hard to predict how many businesses will choose to move to or stay in Oregon because of a lower tax rate, I think that most of the reduction in capital gains revenue would be offset by increased income taxes from business growth and employment. If you do feel the need to further limit the impact on immediate revenue of a capital gains rate cut, you could put a lower, put a lower rate only on gains on Oregon investments, which would solve the issue of the Coca-Cola stock, meaning the investment that the individual is getting the gain on, or you could put a maximum dollar limit on the amount of qualifying gain. But I would encourage you to pass the bills in their current form. It is time to follow the federal model and return fairness, balance, and economic incentives to Oregon's tax on long-term capital gains by slowly returning to a 4.5% rate. I would also like to add some additional comments in regard to a couple of the earlier questions regarding the fact that most of the capital gains benefit technically will go to higher-income individuals. And I think what you need to do, there are two perspectives that you can look at when you're looking at tax policy. One is from the standpoint of equitability and fairness, and another one is more from the standpoint of business of the state of Oregon. And Oregon is, in a sense, a $12 billion business. You collect revenue from individuals, and you provide state services to individuals. For every taxpayer or every resident of the state of Oregon, there is some break-even amount of revenue you receive from them and benefits you give to them in the terms of all of the state services, highways, law enforcement, all general funded services. And I would argue that there's probably an inverse relationship between income and the level of state services that are used. Lower income people qualify for and receive many state services that higher income people do not. Higher income people above a certain point are clearly adding gross new dollars to state revenue that can be used for funds to fund programs for any individual in the state of Oregon. So the real key that I think you need to think of in terms of tax policy is that tax policy is a major motivator of where people choose to locate not only their residence, but even more importantly, their business and the employees that that business brings with them. And if you have a tax policy which discourages people who are going to start businesses, going to have high incomes, and going to employ many people from coming to the state of Oregon, because you feel, in a sense, that reducing capital gains taxes is unfair in that sense, then you're also eliminating those gross dollars that you would be gaining above that break-even threshold that you could be using to pay for state services for those lower-income individuals. So I think you need to keep in mind, too, the impact of these tax changes on the people who live in the state of Oregon and the total level of revenue they contribute to the system in regard to the level of state services that they're receiving. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Questions for Mr. Blackledge? Yes, Representative Hass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really more of a comment, I guess, than anything else. You're kind of harsh on Oregon's business climate. And I, with all due respect, I think we all do a disservice when we badmouth Oregon or its business climate. You know, if you go by national statistics and surveys, I have the Oregon Tax Foundation's survey of 50 states, and Oregon ranked 10th best. It's been in the top 10 for the last few years, and I don't think that's too terrible. Certainly we can improve, but I think this badmouthing of Oregon's business climate just is self-perpetuating, and it just doesn't help anybody.
Chairman Butler, Representative Haas, I would agree. Certainly we don't want to badmouth the state in that regard. One of the problems is that many different, depending upon the nature of the kind of business being studied, the impact of state tax structures has a different impact, whether you're a large C corporation, a small S corporation, fast-growing and profitable, or very slow-growing and with a relatively low profit level. But I've also seen not only lots of studies indicating that we rank relatively poorly in terms of total analysis as a place to do business, but I've also had the personal experience in Corvallis of knowing a very large percentage, I can't tell you exactly what, but a large number of the community leaders in the city of Corvallis who've grown large businesses to the point of profitability and finally retired and sold them, all now live in Vancouver, Washington, or someplace else not in the state of Oregon, and they did that before they sold their business. I've also seen a lot of startup businesses start in Corvallis. We've obviously gone to a great deal of trouble to try to develop new high-technology businesses, spinoffs from HP, spinoffs from the university in that sense. And in many cases, although they start in Corvallis and they're nurtured in Corvallis, when they finally reach that point that they start to become a viable business, and they start to talk about mergers with other businesses of a similar nature, the tendency has been in the city of Corvallis, at least, for them always after they've made that merger, even sometimes when the Corvallis business is the larger of the two businesses, to decide to relocate somewhere else. So we're really good at birthing businesses, but when they really get to that point where they start to look at the tax consequences and the impact, not just on the business entity itself, but particularly on the personal entities of the owners and the key stockholders in the business, they decide to go to other states, such as Colorado, for example, that have lower capital gains.
I guess I would look at that too. I have some concern, having practiced in California, when we say that Oregon at a 9% rate has a lesser, high-end marginal bracket from California, District of Columbia, and Montana. I'd want to take just a brief look at how they calculate adjusted gross income as well. Because if I have $100,000 of ordinary income in Oregon, or in California, or in the District of Columbia, or Montana, and add $10,000 of additional capital gains income in Oregon, I know that's going to cost an additional $900. But it doesn't cost that if it's five-year property in California and having been held in California for a certain period of time. The tax rates, much like some other states that show up on the very low income here, do tend to drop down. So I think it's all relative. You could have I'm anxious to perhaps share that study Representative Hass amongst the committee members if we could, so that we could have the benefit of that all around. But I again, to try and isolate each of those various kinds of things, and Eric, I appreciate your comment that this might be a great place to start a business, but there was a company called Ontario Savings and Loan at one point. That wasn't Ontario, Oregon. It was Ontario, California. Mm-hmm. And my uncle was a shareholder in that corporation. When he got ready to retire, where does he end up? But in Vancouver, Washington. He skipped over the entire state of Oregon after leaving California to sell his shares of the California Savings and Loan, or the Ontario Savings and Loan, while he lived in Vancouver, Washington. An attempt to try and basically say to California and to Oregon, listen, I like the atmosphere of the West Coast, but I just don't like the taxes that we've got in California or in Oregon. So, and of course, with that, as we see that flight of the most portable wealth, outside the state of Oregon, with it goes all of those ordinary income opportunities to have collected, and of course, all of the jobs of the reinvestment, the potential for reinvestment for that. Other questions for Mr. Blackledge? Thank you very much, Eric. We appreciate it. Let's see. Terry Lammers, or Lammers, and then following that, Terry, Bill Linden, and Bill Perry. Did I get your name wrong, Lammers?
Lammers.
Lammers.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Lammers.
Yes. Chairman Butler and members of the committee, my name is Terry Lammers. I live in Polk County, and my brother and I co-manage about 450 acres of timberland we have there. And I'm frequently asked about timberland. You know, how long does it take to before you can get any money from it? You know, is it 10 years? Is it 100? And in the west part of Oregon, it's probably closer to around 30 to 50 years before you can get any substantial revenue. And in the east, maybe a couple centuries. But the people over there, I think, are just a little bit crazy to try to make money growing trees with the current tax system. The nearest financial vehicle to owning and possessing forest land that I can think of is the zero coupon bond. With a zero coupon bond, you don't get a coupon payment, an interest rate payment every year. You put, say, $200 down, then the interest accumulates. And hopefully the company or entity that issued that bond at the end, when it matures, will pay you $1,000. And that's very similar to timberland, because the only difference with timberland, we're hoping that our investment doesn't burn up or blow over or be knocked down by ice or wind storms. And, for example, in the ice and snowstorm of about a year ago on our property, we lost right at 5% of the trees of every age class. No road was passable. And then there's also the possibility of the resource being wiped out by disease, dry weather like what we're having right now, or insects. And then there's always government regulation, a major concern. The current taxation system, when it comes to long-term investments, is totally unfair. For example, if we invest $10 now in a forest-type situation, hoping to get it back in 40 years, there's no difference in the way that $10 is treated. The $10 40 years down the road is valued just the same as the $10 we put in there now. So let's say that we put in $200 and hope to get back $4,000 in 40 years. And let's say we do get back $4,000 on that $200 investment in 40 years. The tax law now currently says that $3,800 is gain. But I ask you, is the $200 from right now and a $200 40 years from now, is it going to buy the same amount of goods? The answer is clearly no. So right now, a long-term investment is taxed. Actually, the tax, much of the tax is on ordinary or the return of capital, which shouldn't be taxed at all. Cutting capital gains rates would go a long ways to repair this inequity in the tax law. I've lived in only two states in my life, Oregon and Alaska. I love Alaska for three reasons. One, it's beautiful. I've never seen any place like it. Number two is, even I can catch fish in Alaska. And the third is, there is no income tax of any sort. In fact, they actually pay their residents to live there. And I spend a great deal of time in the winter in Alaska. I know about the cold, but I love it even then. I have an investment. I've been one of these people that has saved their money, invested it fairly wisely, and I heard a new term today, bunching. It is likely I will have a large bunched capital gain at some point in the future from an investment. And starting approximately 2 years ago, I already started telling people that I might move to Alaska to avoid paying a large tax on, you know, to the state of Oregon. It's just a rational decision on my part, and you know, if anyone would criticize me, I would welcome that, but I would keep in mind that it's rational, and any intelligent person would do that, just like they would go to the restaurant across the street for a $10 meal rather than the one that's $20 if the meal was of the same quality. And they'll shop for cars, you know, and shopping for a state to live in is just as rational. So, therefore, I would like to, and I'd like to point out another thing. I do have a degree in economics. That was a long time ago, but the testimony I've heard from various parties here today, it has brought back some memories of my studies in economics, you know, over 30 years ago. And, you know, there was a tax cut by when Kennedy was in office as president. And if I remember right, the revenues received after that tax cut increased. And I think we need to keep in mind that you can't own me, you can't own my capital, and I will leave. I might go to Alaska, I might go to Washington, but it will be a rational decision on my part, one that I have been making for years. We have been investing in non-Oregon-based businesses that will not be taxed if we live in a different state. This has been a concerted effort on our business's part. Therefore, we have not purchased additional real estate. We have not purchased rental property. We have not purchased anything that would be taxed at a disproportionate rate here in Oregon. We have invested in other publicly traded companies that, if our partners in the business moved to, say, Washington, they would be not taxed on that capital gain. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Limers. Question, Mr. Limers? Thank you again. We appreciate your being here. Let's see. Bill Linden, Bill Perry, please.
Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association. My members support this kind of, I would say, from a different perspective than some of the other business groups. the main draw to this is not necessarily the tax rate reduction to my membership. The bigger issue is we've seen a lot of growth like in Hillsborough and other places, and usually when you can use some sort of a tax law to lure a major corporation into building, that kind of construction really does spur the economy. You see restaurants spring up. You see people just get more active and interested, and they spend a lot more money because they see growth in their community. So the things that you can do as legislators that basically increase economic activity of on a large scale in a community, it's going to benefit all the retail businesses. And usually restaurants are the economic indicators. When a recession comes, we feel it first. When an economic boom comes first, we usually feel it first. So our members are anxious for those economic booms in the community, because once they happen, our members really see an increased sales. So we like this because even though it's a slight reduction over a long period of day, what we want to see is somebody looking towards an investment in a future, and once they make that investment, I think you'll start to see the retail community benefit from it. So that's our main reason why it's one of our legislative priorities in session, and I'd be happy to answer any question or not, Mr. Linden.
Thank you. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Metals Industry Council. I want to tell you a little bit about why the council is interested in this issue and has been for years. The member companies within the Metals Industry Council are large, modest in size. They're located in different parts of the state. They serve different markets. They produce different products. But one thing they've been unified on is support for things that they believe are, in the long run, going to have a beneficial impact on growing Oregon's economy and strengthening the economic base we have in this state. And from day one that we've worked with them, capital gains tax reduction has been at the top of their list. So they, again, although they're different in their approach, they're different in their in the types of products and they produce and how their businesses operate, there's a common interest in this issue as a factor that they think is going to be beneficial in the short and long run for Oregon. The current capital gains tax rate, they believe, is a disincentive to investment in Oregon, and they will support, I know you have various proposals in front of you on capital gains, they will support an improvement in the capital gains tax rate climate in Oregon, and we look forward to working with the committee to see what we can do.
Thank you very much. Questions for either Mr. Linden or Mr. Perry? Thank you again. I appreciate it. Let's see. Tim Nesbitt after 2 o'clock. Tim, I think I saw him here. Tim is here, and Ralph Gromer. And Ralph, you were signed up on both bills, so you can testify on both. I'll only give you half as long, though.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. It's not like we haven't testified on this issue before. I was looking at my files. It goes back to 2001, 2003, similar bills. And the concerns we have are much the same. I want to start, though, with one issue that I think prior speakers and maybe those who also oppose these bills haven't raised, and that is the troubling tendency of passing these tax reduction bills when you recognize you can't afford to give up the revenue they would forego in the coming budget period, and so you postpone their effects to future years. I think you have something like $50 to $70 million less to work with in balancing your budget in 2005-2007 because of decisions like that that you made in the 2001 and 2003 sessions. And eventually you've got to square up the revenue losses with the demands for funding for services. So the first point we'd like to make is that if you can't afford to do it now, wait. Don't do it now. If there's no way that you can be certain that in the future there isn't a way that you can balance the budget without the kind of revenue losses you're seeing in the out years, then wait. Don't approve those. Don't approve this kind of reduction now. And finally, if you're not squaring up the revenues lost as projected under this bill,
with the competing needs that are being dealt with in other rooms in this building every day about how we fund services that are so vital to our quality of life and our business climate, including education from grade school to graduate school and keeping it affordable, then how do you know you're really making your best effort to kind of look at the alleged values and benefits from this tax reduction and the alleged values and benefits, including benefits to our business climate, for maintaining funding for services like education that are so vital to our businesses and our economy? Second, we urge you not to shift, again, more of the responsibility for supporting these essential services from our least needy taxpayers, from our well-to-do families, to families who are struggling to make ends meet with every paycheck. And there's no doubt about it here that if this were enacted, it would be a big boon to those who receive income from the sale of appreciated assets. But if anything, we'll shift more of the responsibility for maintaining services to those who live from paycheck to paycheck. Thirdly, I'd like to respond to what Mr. Blackledge said about our business climate. And I served with him on one of those same task forces on tax reform. Let's recognize that in the big picture, taking all taxes into account, we have a tax system which is favorable to our economy in a lot of ways. We are, in effect, we have kind of a general tax system, right? We don't, if you're operating in Oregon and you're not making a profit, you're not paying sales taxes as you do in California and Washington, you're not paying gross receipts taxes as you're doing in Washington, regardless of whether you're profitable. You're really only paying, at the local level, your property taxes, and at the state level, your income taxes, and the latter are only paid when and if you turn a profit. So that's why we're so kind to startups, and that's why we're so gentle during recessions. If you're not earning a profit, you're not paying anything more than a $10 minimum tax to the state of Oregon. Couldn't be much kinder and gentler than that. And the flip side is that when you do make a profit, you pay. But you know what? You pay only the same tax rates that working families pay on their paychecks. Isn't that fair? Isn't that a fair part of the bargain? We're kind and gentle to startups. We're kind to companies when they're on hard times. When they're profitable, we expect them to pay only the same tax rates that working families pay on their paychecks. And by the way, we all know we pay our taxes mostly on our gross. Businesses pay their taxes on their net. Now, but let me go to what I know you're dealing with as the most compelling rationale for this kind of a tax reduction. And that is that somehow if you're even kinder and gentler to investment income, that will somehow produce more jobs and a better economy. Well, first of all, keep in mind what the trade-off is if we can't support a adequate and high-quality education system, public services, safe communities. Secondly, you know, that connection just isn't supported by the data. A couple of examples. Minnesota has one of the highest taxes on capital gains. It has a 4.4% unemployment rate. Hawaii taxes capital gains at 8.5%. They're richer than we are in personal income and have a 3% unemployment rate. So it's specious to argue that there's an automatic connection here. Secondly, we think it would be irresponsible of you to enact this proposal on the theory that it's going to promote job creation without checking to make sure that, A, you're not subsidizing transactions that would have occurred otherwise, B, you're not rewarding taxpayers with tax cuts for shifting their assets out of state, and C, we're not giving away scarce revenue that's so critical to maintaining the services that are so important to our state without making sure we're getting something concrete, certain, tangible, quantifiable in return. You know, there are some tax breaks that we support. The Strategic Investment Program is a good example because it does deal with the much more competitive factor of property taxes. And it offers a quid pro quo when every local county commission sits down to negotiate with the business over how many jobs it will receive in return for the tax break. That's the responsible way of dealing with the need for tax breaks and subsidies for good employers when we get good jobs in return and we can prove we're getting them in return. This across-the-board approach is least effective. When you get your OTIM study, you're going to see that if it's like what we saw 2 years ago and 3 years ago, if anything, the projected jobs way out 5 years from now, after you add up all the revenue losses, will cost about $30,000 per job. Not a cost-effective way of promoting the economic vitality of our state. Not fair to Oregon's working families. And certainly more of a problem down the line when it comes to trying to balance the budget to maintain the service we all care about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of Mr. Nesbitt?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Olson.
Thank you. Mr. Nesbitt, I'm curious. I was taking some notes. And are you familiar with the tax cut that President Kennedy introduced back 61-63?
Representative, I haven't... read about it recently, but I do remember it.
Okay.
Yes.
My understanding is that there was an increase in revenue as a result of that. Why would that be?
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, we're dealing with a different situation. And we had marginal tax rates as high as 90%. And we're dealing with a federal tax system which had much more of an impact on economic activity than one state system does now in terms of investment decisions. So I would want to look carefully at the equation that produced the revenue returns from that tax cut and those that have failed to deliver similar offsetting revenue increases ever since the Reagan tax cuts of the 80s, and the whole debate about the Arthur Laffer theory, which he wrote on the back of a napkin, that if you cut taxes in 1 year, you're going to get back offsetting revenue in the next. We spent a lot of time in the late 90s when I was before this committee talking about the impact of tax reductions and the so-called static versus dynamic outcomes. Well, that's why I also sat on another committee called the Oregon Tax Incidence Model Committee, which was created to produce a statistical model to test that theory. I think you will get a report from your staff on with the use of that model that will answer that question. If down the road we actually get offsetting revenue, any kind of revenue increases from other economic activity that will offset the losses from this revenue reduction. And if it looks like the report we got 2 years ago, it doesn't come close. It doesn't come close.
Follow up, Representative.
I'm not really clear what he said. I mean, there was too many big words for me, but I think I'm done there.
Okay, thank you. Representative Galizio?
Two issues. One, what about the argument? A couple people made the argument that while we might be kind and gentle for startups, once companies are successful or individuals are very successful, the status quo is an incentive to go elsewhere. And then secondly, isn't it attractive for, let's say, the governor to go to businesses that we want to have locate here and as part of a larger package, say, and also we have a very low or competitive capital gains tax rate?
Well, first, if I may, Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, there was a study done by the Oregon Center for Public Policy looking at the years 1993 to 2001 and the behavior of Oregonians with capital gains income. That study found that for every 10,000 Oregonians with capital gains income, a grand total of 16 moved to Clark County.
What were the years?
93 to 2001. And most of those years were high capital gains years. So, of course, you can, after you have been successful and have accumulated assets, whether through real estate or business activities of other kind of make that calculation. But the flip side would be then, would you rather have a tax system that taxes a business more on the front end when they're not profitable, or one based on ability to pay, where you tax a business when it is profitable? And I think that's the choice reflected in our tax system now. And to say that you'd lop off returns in revenue that are so important to our business climate from the services they can support when a business is profitable and also not tax on the front end when it's starting up or not having a profit, then I think you're no longer in any way asking for a fair tax system.
Sure. Let me just follow up on that if I could, Tim. What year, do you know what year it was, and I'm really not trying to put you on the spot, what year it was that the tax court case that Oregon eventually lost relative to the moving of capital gains outside of the state of Oregon, but still having to pay the tax on them if you changed your Oregon residence. Do you remember when that court case came down?
I'm sorry, I don't remember that case in particular. Representative Butler,
it's proven to be unconstitutional, and I'm trying to put a year on it. It was sometime between 1993 and 2001, and for a long period of time, people could not move their capital gains outside of the state of Oregon, and then change the residency outside of the state of Oregon without having to accelerate and pay the Oregon tax on it. They had to file an affidavit with the state of Oregon, assuring the state of Oregon that if they followed their gains outside of the state of Oregon at some later point in time, that instantly they would have to pay their tax. That was eventually determined to be unconstitutional. Again, that may well be the reason why the folks did not, why they stayed in Oregon and paid the capital gains. I know I had a number of clients who were investing on the Oregon border and could not move gains into the state of Idaho, where the capital gains rate is, I think it's shown here on the schedule at number 14 in the nation. They couldn't move those gains out because of Oregon's somewhat confiscatory policy to try and tax those gains even when they weren't in the state of Oregon. So it just demonstrates the complexity of the issues that we're dealing with here. Now that those gains, and I think going back to Terry Lammer's comments, you've got folks that are making intentional business decisions to make sure that they do not invest in anything more in Oregon than what they absolutely have to, recognizing that the time will come when they anticipate actually packing up and moving from the state of Oregon and can actually do the exchanges. And I assume that's probably what is involved here, is a contemplated series of exchanges which will end up with Oregon timber being exchanged for Washington or Washington timber or other kinds of investment property, and or to Alaska to move those gains into states where the capital gains rates are much more favorable in Oregon. And of course, when Oregon is surrounded with Nevada, Idaho, Washington, with smaller capital gains here in the Northwest, it makes it just that much easier. So I'm anxious about the timing of the studies that are done that show that people don't move to pay their capital gains. I think we've had a number of folks testify that, I think one of the folks testified he didn't, I think it was Mr. Blackledge, that said, you know, those startup businesses that had been successful had eventually all moved outside the community. And I think we face that on a regular basis. I've worked with a group for the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, And they have some proposals to try and do something with regard to the capital gains as well. Concerned about the fact that where Oregon is a nice startup state and you don't pay the sales tax and you don't pay many of the other kinds of taxes that perhaps you would be paying in some of the other taxes or in the other states, a gross receipts tax or anything like that, that once the business is successful, then Oregon's tax rates really don't incent them to continue to stay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would, Mr. Chair, want to state that we share the concern about jobs.
You bet.
And what I would go on to say, though, is that I'm not that concerned about somebody with a lot of appreciated assets moving out of state in order to sell those assets and pay lesser tax. I'm concerned if those assets otherwise would have been reinvested in Oregon and would have promoted jobs in Oregon. That's why we thought the tax break on the books in the late 90s, passed in the 95 session of the legislature, which I think has since expired, for reinvestment of capital gains in Oregon made more sense. And that's the kind of targeted approach that I'm asking you to consider. If the argument for this change is for job creation in Oregon, look at a policy that will really demonstrate results and not reward transactions and investors who otherwise are going to take their money out of the state, which I think is where most of the revenue losses are going
to
go here.
Yeah, and I it'll be interesting to have a report on that law that was passed and has since sunsetted.
because I don't think it was really super effective in keeping any of that profit here in the state of Oregon. I mean, we got to come up with a better mousetrap in that process. Representative Hass?
Thanks. I was just going to ask, Tim, if you or your organization could support cutting the capital gain tax rate if it were part of a larger sweeping tax reform effort.
If it were part of a package, that made sense. Yes, then we would look at all aspects. I think every session when you enact, whether it's single sales factor or a tax break for this or a tax break for that, it makes the remaining problem a little harder to negotiate over to a common solution that we think would be both fair in terms of who pays and adequate in terms of the revenues we need to support the services we care about.
Of course, one of the difficulties of that, Representative Hass, is that, you know, just 2 years ago, and this, when looking at Elizabeth's schedule here, the amount of personal income taxes that are collected off of these capital gains. Remember, we went from an $800 million biennial tax collection down to a little over $100 million biennial tax collection from the capital gains. That would have been the time when we should have blown the whistle and said, wait a minute, where we are so dependent upon capital gains and this bubble through the system, now that we're back up over $200 million and anticipating, you know, going to $500 million by 2011, it starts, you know, you try and communicate with folks, we should be doing something about Oregon's tax system, which is so dependent on capital gains. And now they're saying, well, what's the problem? We don't see a problem. When 2 years ago we were coming around here grousing about the fact that capital gains had gone down by over 80%. And we were looking at that saying we really should ought to do something about this. And now that opportunity, that window of opportunity appears to have maybe gone by. But I appreciate your being proactive, Representative Bass, and taking a look at that.
Thanks. It does remind, Oregon reminds me of the farmer with the leaky roof. He can't fix it in the winter because it's raining, and he doesn't fix it in the summer because it isn't leaking.
Right.
And that's kind of how we approach tax reform in the state, unfortunately. Maybe that'll change.
Representative Bolton?
Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of curious. The study that was mentioned by Mr. Nesbitt for the 9301 for the behavior of Oregonians leaving the state, do we have that available to us?
I'm sure we can get it for you.
I'd be happy to help with that.
Thank you.
Since I have the citation here.
Other questions for Mr. Nesbitt? Yes. Representative Riley is recognized.
Yeah. Does that study show what people who had capital gains moved into the state as well?
From the description in my prepared testimony, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think so. Okay. Representative.
Thank you. Ralph?
Thank you, Chair Butler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I represent the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 75. Tim hit some of the points, very few, because mine's not going to be an intellectual testimony. You can go ahead and laugh. It's more from perception and kind of from the seat of my pants. I've learned more today from all of you than I know, but I would like to make a few comments anyway on behalf of my members. And that is that I sat on the Revenue Committee in 73, 75, and I really watched this committee more, I don't know the word for it, maybe from a social psychological perspective than most since 73, actually preceding that when I followed revenue in Oregon. And I have to tell you that I've changed substantially in my view. I've supported some tax incentives for various industries that I felt would stimulate the economy. And I have to say that my change may well reflect a bigger vision of the history of Oregon and the Revenue Committee. And I look at the committee today and I say, my God, that may be really what it is. Because every session we have five or six new members on the committee, and it's really not your fault. You're a veteran now, those of you who have been here a while. But having observed the Revenue Committee for many years, longer, I think, than anyone except a few in the audience, what occurred to me through my life is that you know, I was told by Don McIntyre in what was that, 1990, would Measure 5 personally when I had to debate him. I was one of the co-chairs against Measure 5, but I do understand if you voted for it, because we were one of the highest property tax states in America, and that was going to happen. But I was told by Don, who's very good at debate, as some, if not all of you are, that there's no problem, and he told Oregonians this would just be picked up. And then I went, and I had the wonderful advantage of being able to sit in the Ways and Means for most budgets, since I have many of the budgets. And at the same time, I follow revenue, so I get to sit in revenue. And I've my observation was, even in the halcyon days, that's a big word for a union guy, but I'll look it up later. I wrote it down. I wanted to use it. Was the fact that why were we holding the budgets even when high tech was, especially Intel, was fueling this economy in the 90s? And then it occurred to me, my God, what's happening is that the amount going for K-12 had grown astronomically and was taking money away. You say away. To some, it's a reduction. Others, it wasn't. But it was a reduction. An example was my state police. I have all the support staff, labs. I use that. I've watched that agency. It just epitomizes the problem in Oregon. Cut in half, and it's dead and dying. You know, so my point is, look, if capital gains, I'll make it short, is so good, because I've had my friends, and I really, Scott Brune is representative from my old district, and he's a wonderful person, and Joe, I've grown to even like AOI, I've really grown. The fact is, everyone comes in front of this committee all these years and has said, this will stimulate the economy. Where I'm probably more cynical because you're newcomers is that I really have learned that what I wish we could have done through all those tax breaks, I call them. And the biggest one, thank you, is for me on my home. And I appreciate that, and I don't want you touching it because that's the only one I have left as a taxpayer. But I would suggest we never said, by the way, you're coming back, I don't know, next session, and you're going to show us how many jobs you created. By the way, it's important to me. Was that a flipping a hamburger? And that's what but we spent $30,000 for it, or did we in fact get a good deal for our money? Because it isn't just mine or yours; it's the citizens of Oregon's money. It's like a bank. So we loan you the money, and we ought to get some return on that. And I look at these kind of breaks, and again, I've testified for some of them, and we'll support some this year, especially for veterans in Iraq and that kind of thing, my union. We have lots of members, 250 of them over there, out of my corrections facilities throughout Oregon. So we care about that. But I have to say, if I've grown to be cynical, it's because we haven't demonstrated through proven technology, which I don't like to make so complicated. If we're going to have a tax break, then we ought to be able to come back the next session and say, here, this, I like simple things. We created 200 jobs, and here was their average salary. And by the way, they had benefits for their children, health benefits, and they aren't charging the state of Oregon like certain companies are and handing out forms for the employees to fill out so they can get on the Oregon health plan. I won't tell you who that company is. But so what my sensitivity analysis is that we have been more stimulated to continue to give away tax breaks, to rein them in once passed, if they don't and can't prove economic stimulation and job creation. We're all for job creation. We've got to do it. Oregonians are hit on the rear end when they're born. There's no sales tax. I personally stood up for a sales tax when I was county commissioner and elected, and I'm still for one. That's me, but I'm what, 10% of the population? So boom, that's dead. Everything I've ever supported, the public doesn't, so you'd probably say, why are you testifying here? So I'm all for stimulating the economy and job growth. That's the only way we really have to go. So my comment then is, if in fact this is that important, why don't we reduce or increase, why don't we reduce commensurate tax breaks? Now, hold it. That's common sense to me. and say, if this is the most important, I've heard four or five of them say, by golly, this is it, and this is why we have to do it, then why don't we reduce some of the other tax breaks we've given? You know, I just watched over the last 6 years to epitomize what I was saying. We've gone from, what, Tim, 39 cents in each tax dollar we pay, or 36 just 6 years ago. 36 cents. Now it's up to 49 cents out of every tax dollar, according to revenue, that is going away to tax breaks. Now, that may not sound astounding, but just in that last six years, if we hadn't have done that, we wouldn't have had a deficit at all coming into this session. So there's a legitimate argument on both sides of this. On the one hand, I hear folks who are good people, smarter than me, saying we need more breaks, and this is the biggest, evidently, this is the king of them all. This evidently has some legitimate legs to stand on from everyone that's brighter than me, I hear. But I keep hearing this every session, and more money keeps coming out of my tax dollar that goes to the breaks, yet we're still one of the highest unemployment. You know all the, you know the problems better than I do. You chair these committees. I mean, we have problems in every committee and every agency. Mine's mostly public safety, where I have the problems. And I mean, I have county sheriffs, city police, corrections, district attorneys, the attorney general, state police. So I could go on. I have Board of Police Standards and Training. In not just K through 12 and higher ed is suffering in Oregon, public safety is suffering in Oregon. I'd like you to understand. So it's a gamble. It's a roll of the dice. And if it's not a gamble, we need people to document it and prove it. And if they're willing to prove it, then it needs to be, here's our test. This is what we're going to come back with. We're going to show you that the economy did this. And if not, I think what we ought to do is say, look, let's get rid of these tax breaks over here. They didn't prove themselves. They never have. And by the way, in my opinion, I'm so cynical, they never will. It's just that we come in front of you and say, this is a good idea. All they always say the same thing. Every 40 years, they've said the same thing. It'll stimulate the economy.
So
no one has ever proved it.
Bill.
What?
You for or against this bill? I'm having trouble.
I'm for this bill. If you were to wipe out an additional, a commensurate amount, the $339 million from other tax breaks, and then you say, "Here's our new break. We just wipe that out so that we're even on the table." How's that?
Well, I'd go back to what Representative Haas very diplomatically asked Mr. Nesbitt. If this is part of a package, are you for it?
Oh, of course, if the package
Wonderful.
Starts meeting the Thank standards you. I'm addressing, yes. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Groner?
Just a comment for the record. There are many union members who are very comfortable with polysyllabic language.
Okay. With that, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony here today. Our final person that signed up is Dana Hepper. Stand for Children. Dana?
Chair Butler and members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to testify today. I got here first and signed up first, so I'm not sure how I ended up last, but
well,
here I am.
Well, I'm sorry. We took the other bill first, and you did sign up first on 2332,
totally
but
fine.
It was only you and Ralph. And because he was already here on the other bill, the first shall be last.
That's
well,
right.
Look at that.
That's right. But hopefully, I'm here today to speak on behalf of children, and hopefully children will not be last as we move forward this session. We have 550,000 school children in Oregon today, and they can't be here to speak for themselves. They are in school, or at least were when I arrived. I won't
probably out for spring break. Dana.
I'll spare you from reading my testimony.
Dana,
but
do you want to introduce yourself for the record, too, please?
Yeah, for the record, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm a former teacher in the North Clackamas School District and the Salem Kaiser organizer for Stand for Children. 3 weeks ago, over 3,000 Oregonians stood on the Capitol steps to remind us that public education is our Oregonians' first priority. I'll spare you from reading my testimony, but I do want to skip down to the bullet points regarding why Stand for Children is opposed to this legislation. We're hearing time and time again that cutting capital gains will increase investment, and yet when we look at the research that's shown not to be the case, the Congressional Research Service found in 1999 that there was no relationship between venture capital and venture capital investments and the capital gains tax. And in fact, in 1999, as you probably know, both the House and Senate at the federal level were controlled by Republicans. So that's just a little bit of context. I won't repeat what Tim Nesbitt said, but that the idea that there are all these people running to Clark County is simply not held up by evidence, by data, 16 out of 10,000. So it's a very small number who are moving to Clark County. Time and time again, when we ask small businesses what they need to be successful, what they're saying is that they need to lower the cost of health insurance for their employees. And this bill does nothing to address that concern.
It doesn't address crime either. Did you notice that?
It also doesn't address crime.
Right. Okay.
It also doesn't address a well-educated workforce. I just wanted to respond to a couple things that I heard earlier. Representative Bruhn was here to support lowering capital gains from 9%, which is relatively high compared to other states. But 9% is also the same rate that we ask our highest income Oregonians to pay as an income tax. And we heard at the beginning that 48% of those people who are paying capital gains, 48% of capital gains revenue would go to those folks making over $500,000 a year. It would take me about 20 years to earn $500,000. That's just a reminder. Cutting the capital gains tax to 5% would mean that wealthy Oregonians who are making money off tax sales would actually be paying less on that income than hardworking Oregonians who pay about 5.5% on average of their income in taxes. And that's approximately what I pay. And I find it a little bit unfair that the wealthiest Oregonians would be paying less in taxes for doing very little work than I pay for doing very hard work. Representative Bruhn offered up a month's income if his predictions don't pan out. I look forward to the state receiving that, but I am concerned that a month of Representative Bruhn's income will not make up for the lost revenue to the state and will not pay for public education, which is what we really need to do if we're thinking about the long-term future of our state. As a working Oregonian making less than $30,000 a year, who will not benefit from reducing the capital gains tax, I can't afford to bet a month's salary on my prediction, but I feel confident that the state will not benefit from this legislation. There's also been significant testimony stating that this would make Oregon a more business-friendly state. And there was a study done by the National Center for Policy Analysis. 17 states give favorable tax treatment to capital gains, either by exempting capital gains income from taxation or treating it more favorably than ordinary income. And of these 17 states, some of them are high-income, high-employment states. Some of them are low-income, high unemployment states. And two of the 17 are among the 10 richest, meaning 15 of the 17 are not. So that really shows no relationship between favorable treatment of capital gains income and the wealth, employment level, or income level of a state. It seems ironic to me that we're considering tax breaks to wealthier Americans as we are making cuts to schools. The $12 million number that's been thrown around as potential cost would make up for the cuts to Head Start this session in the governor's budget. That, to me, is not an okay trade-off. I would much rather be sending those kids to pre-K so that our kindergarten and first grade teachers are getting kids who are capable of being in a classroom. it's also ironic to me that we're doing this in the face of the second largest class sizes in the nation and in the face of one of the shortest school years in the nation. Our economy would be much better served by at least holding the line on our K-12 education system, and especially if we began to restore some of the cuts that have been already made to that system. We need a better developed workforce, and we need to show companies that are interested in relocating here that we are no longer lampooned in Doonesbury comic strips as the poster child for disinvestment in education. Thank you.
Thank you, Dana. Questions of Dana Heffer? Thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. We appreciate your testimony. Colleagues, with that, we're run a little bit over time, and just about as much as we got started late, however. So with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bills 2332 and 2574, and that's it for House Revenue for today.